I'm Alex Hirsch. I'm the voice of Jeff the Gnome.
Hi, I'm Mike Orianda. I'm the voice of Mr. Poolcheck.
I'm Matt Chapman, and I had the wrong name on my office door on Gravity Falls.
What was the name on your door?
Wasn't that Krampelter?
Oh, yeah, Krampelter Associates.
Krampelter in accounting?
A name we eventually stuck in the series.
Yeah.
So Gideon Rises. This was a very big, important episode for us. A lot of things hinged on this. I loved the idea that for this first season, Gideon would be our big bad. You know, I knew that somebody would eclipse him by the time the series was over, but a little kid being Stan's arch enemy is just always really funny to see how furious Stan gets by Gideon. And this idea that Gideon has some knowledge that he doesn't know about the portal, but he knows there's something powerful about the shack because he found journal number 2 and it makes reference to it, and that those questions are really hot. I like the idea that there's a couple of characters who know things that we don't know. Bill knows things that we don't know. Gideon knows things that we don't know. It's ambiguous about Stan, and when those tensions rise, that's when you really start to get satisfaction in terms of storytelling and mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Figuring out how to actually assemble this plot, though, was quite difficult.
Yeah, totally. I mean, this episode was hard, too, because it was really important to us to have a season finale that was satisfying, because when we watch shows, so many season finales would be like, they'd be like, oh, it would be this great climax leading to a cliffhanger, and it wouldn't give you any answers. And we really struggled. Like, we had multiple versions where the answer at the end of the episode was kind of lame or weak, and we would show board arts, and they'd be like, yeah, this is boring. And we just had to keep working it until we finally came up with a satisfying ending.
Satisfying was the thing that we kept coming back to, which is if people have followed the series up until this point and they're invested in all these threads, how do we create maximum tension for our characters and maximum relief? Like, how do we get people to feel like they saw a little movie, like this was a full meal? And the idea of threatening to send the kids home felt like that's how you ratchet up the stakes in a way we've never seen before. Because even though the last episode had Bill Cipher threatening to destroy Stan's mind and Gideon taking the Mystery Shack, the show itself being at stake was how we ratcheted that up. And we weren't, you know, at this point, we didn't know for sure what was going to come next. Like, I was super worn out. I wasn't even sure I was going to do another season after this. We didn't know how this would all be received. And so we said, okay, well, let's make this as satisfying as it can possibly be. You know, not knowing what's coming next. And if there is something coming next, it's going to be a really long hiatus. So let's try to make this one full piece.
Yeah, totally. Well, and another thing, too, it's like, I feel like that's the way that we top the sort of over-the-top crazy dream fight of Dreamscapers was having the kids leaving at stake because it felt more real and tangible, and like Stan calling their parents and not having money for pizza, like, felt like, wow, this, like, the stakes just got real in a way we haven't seen them get in the show before, which means maybe there could be a real change that we haven't seen before, because you always want the stakes to feel authentic, like the bad thing could actually happen to the characters.
Well, and you want to raise them. And that was the challenge for season 2. And I think it's one of these things where, okay, if in you know, prior episodes, the stakes were, you know, the mystery of the week going wrong, you know, the danger.
Yeah.
And then in this episode, the stakes are the kids leaving town. How do you ratchet that up? Our answer in season 2 was the stakes are their relationships.
Yeah.
Something that could potentially destroy the relationship between Stan, Dipper, Mabel, Seuss. Like, that's as far as you can get.
Yeah.
Is personal relationship stakes. And we were still kind of figuring out how that all worked. This setup with Stan's hearing aid. I don't think he's ever had a hearing aid before or referenced since, but we needed I was really inspired by Who Shot Mr. Burns, the classic Simpsons episode parody of Who Shot JR, because that was my introduction to mystery and the subtle clues they had. So we were trying to figure out, okay, that sets up that there's a camera with feedback inside the Gideon pins, which is the way that the townsfolk turn against Gideon, which is that they don't really care that he's a fraud, but they do care that he's been spying on them.
Yeah.
And we really loved the idea that Gideon was going to prison at the end of this.
Yeah, well, it set up a nice thing in Act 2 where it's like, that was something that we really like from like shows like Arrested Development, where it's like, oh, you can find new, you can get new sort of story meat out of characters by putting them in new situations, like, and putting Gideon in jail.
You can shift the status quo.
Yeah.
Matt, do you recall anything about the writer's room breaking of this episode?
Yeah, I remember things like that, the hearing aid and figuring out, like, okay, how do we make everybody turn on Gideon? How do we make the town turn on Gideon? I feel like there are multiple ways to try and do that, too. And originally, I think maybe that was sort of the issue, was at first it was just a couple of people that he, like, upset. Yeah. And then finally we were like, oh, wait, what's a way that he can betray all of Gravity Falls? Yeah. And then at the end, they actually love Stan for at least a minute, you know, maybe part of his montage. That may get reset next season, but...
It was
difficult. It was, but it was, this one I felt like was more fun. Like, it was frustrating. The issues with Dreamscapers was like frustrating and kind of hard to get through. This one was like, felt fun because you kind of knew that it's like, well, this is the finale. So no matter what, it's going to be awesome. It's going to be huge.
Yeah.
So it was a little more fun to figure out those problems.
This was challenging, but we knew the broad feelings that we were going for by the end of it. We knew that we were going to threaten everything that the Pines have and then get it back. And we knew how good that was going to feel. And we've been making Gideon such a little jerk that we knew how good it was going to feel to see that smirk wiped off his face. These scenes were very difficult to choreograph. They were rewritten a lot, this scene with these flashbacks. Because we needed to put this idea in your mind. We kept changing the wording on it. This idea, okay, it's a gateway to power. We were trying to figure out, how do we make it plausible that Gideon has read something in this journal that makes him aware of... The way that I excuse this in my mind, my headcanon, is in journal number 3, Ford gets the idea of building this portal, but he connects all 3 journals to do the final diagram of it. And so Gideon just has a single page referencing this incredible, you know, has a single page referencing this portal to ultimate power and that it's underneath the shack because he had the shack at that point. That's how I justify that concept.
Yeah.
I have to give a shout out to that glamour shot that's on the back wall with Seuss with his hands up against the wall and like looking over his shoulder like, oh, what's up? That's maybe one of my favorite things.
I think that was drawn by Matt Brawley.
Yeah, it looks like it.
I also would like to point out that usually with those slot cars, you can't actually push them around the track like that, because I remember doing it,
resistance.
And it would just scrape the track and make this horrible like sound and then ruin your older brother's slot car racers.
Something we thought a lot about and that I had learned from actually listening to other commentaries is you notice that we like starting and ending our acts and our episodes on images that set up what the entire act and episode is about. Mm-hmm. So this episode starts with an image of the entire town being covered with a shadow to suggest the danger they're in. This act ends with journal number 3 in Dipper's hands basically saying, like, this is the episode we're going to address the journal. Like, a lot of time went into thinking about that. It's sort of subtle, but I think it sets your expectations. This is another late idea. We had talked about this this grappling hook payoff, which I think pays off so well, but I remember when I first looked at the storyboard of this realizing, uh-oh, we didn't set it up enough.
Yeah.
So we have a couple of different lines about the grappling hook to make it maximally satisfying when it comes back.
Yeah, because anytime you bring something back... It's like sometimes you get up your own butt about these shows where it's like, oh, everyone remembers the grappling hook, but it's like not everyone is making the show in the room with you and remembering every detail of every episode, so you have to remind them.
Well, and binge watching didn't exist at this point.
Yeah,
you know what
true.
I mean? So we didn't know what people were going to see.
The
key that I found to introducing setup in an episode like that is if you can make it seem like a joke when it arrives, people don't say, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah.
Like, in both of those scenes where Mabel uses her grappling hook, there's, like, a little punchline at the end. So you could believe that it's just... The point is, Mabel's a goofball.
Yeah.
So that hopefully you don't expect it to actually fully save the day. Or even if you do, you're still satisfied when it arrives.
Yeah, like, I remember... I feel like Jelly Grab was in there, and then we added later on to just really ram it home, get Dipper saying the thing about... Mabel, literally, that thing has never come in handy ever. Like, it was like, how do we punch it up even more? And we're just like, let's just have him say, like, you've never used that once to save our lives.
Yeah.
And in the end, it saves their
wink,
lives.
Wink, wink.
And then Jibba Jelly Grab and it getting all over Seuss's grandma looking like, originally, wasn't it going to be strawberry too? So it looked like blood.
Yeah.
One of the originals. And so it was going to be super over the top.
This B story with Seuss getting a side job, this was one of those things that I think probably in our very first outlines and drafts was like a huge plot point.
Yeah.
There was a lot of jokes about Seuss's alternate jobs. And of course, it had to be streamlined for time. But I actually think we threaded the needle on this one just the right amount.
Yeah, no, it was good. I wrote like a way too long, many page extended sequence of all the different jobs, and it was like basically like a day. And here's how Seuss manages it, and it showed you like the seven different jobs he has. Like
12 jobs.
Yeah, that was super funny stuff. It can be really hard to fit all the story we want in this episode. And this episode, I actually desperately campaigned the studio to let us have an extra minute of time, because when we brought this episode into the edit bay and we watched it, we realized, like, this thing was coming together. It was going to be really exciting, but it needed time. It needed time for setup. It needed time for certain ideas to land.
And some areas felt like it was in fast forward or something.
We were worried that parts of the show were playing too fast for you to believe the stakes.
Yeah.
And so I desperately, again and again, wrote 100 emails. Please give us the minute. Please give us the minute. I'll give you my blood. And finally, they relented. That became a lot harder in season two. They moved channels, and we had different act breaks, and it was a whole thing.
Your Majesty, the most beautiful girl we've ever seen.
I am not a girl!
Really? But your skin is so soft. Do you moisturize or...
Subdue them!
This whole turn right here with Gideon has the whistle that knocks them out, this took a lot of figuring out. We had a lot of...
Oh, yeah.
It was very difficult, the second act, figuring out how it was going to... We knew how we wanted to start and end.
Yeah.
But figuring out how we would ratchet up the stakes, this idea that Gideon gets Dipper's journal, and Gideon basically tells Dipper, you're nothing without this journal. Because that's as much of an arc as we have in this story,
yeah.
Is Dipper believing that he needs the journal. And we don't really introduce that arc mm-hmm. until this point, which is late to introduce a sort of character flaw.
Yeah.
You know?
Time, do your own dirty work. Come on, boys.
Well, that's it. Guess the bus should be here soon.
What? Dipper, don't give up. You always have a plan.
No, the journal always has the plan. Think about it, Mabel. Gideon was right.
So this thing Dipper's saying right now, the speech, totally doesn't actually work. If you go back and watch the show, there's tons of times where Dipper saved the day without any kind of journal. But again, it felt
Mermando.
Like... Yeah, like, exactly. Like, but we believed... Dipper's an insecure character. And a character like... Even a character like Gideon, who's just a snotty kid, him telling Dipper, like, you've got nothing on me without that book. I believe that Dipper could believe it. And I believe that we could sell that feeling to the audience. Joe Pitt animated that scene right there, like those extra poses.
Well, and I thought the board artists did a great job here of just like selling emotionally that this was real.
Yeah.
Because if you don't board that right, and if the music isn't right, you're like, they're not really going home. But if you play it to the audience, like this is really happening, they'll believe it and get scared for the kids.
This is a huge cheat. The idea that Gideon knew that there was, two journals, but he didn't know there was a third journal, and now he needs to chase them to get the first journal. This was one of those things where you've got cards on the wall. It's like, we know that we want this big chase.
Yeah.
We know that we want big action like we've never seen before. We know that in our second episode we saw a plesiosaur that was a robot, so we can have a giant mech, and we know that McGucket can build it.
Yeah.
Like, we have these sort of clusters of images and things that we want to see. We want to build this idea that Gideon has become all-powerful and make him physically manifest, but logically... There's that little logic hiccup of, wait a minute, Gideon's already got everything he wants.
Yeah.
Why is he chasing them? Something like that, we kind of add a... I wouldn't call it a plot hole, but I would call it a convenience or a contrivance.
Yeah.
And you just kind of...
Well, it's like, why does he need to get in a robot?
Yeah, why does he need to get in the
he
robot?
He doesn't really need to get in a robot.
You know, you hope that the audiences forgive those little conveniences and contrivances if they result in something that's entertaining. And if where we want, and if we pay off enough things, if there's enough satisfaction that we can kind of... spackle over those cracks in the wall.
Well, and it's plausible enough because he's building this Gideon Land thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Shout out to Justin Roiland, voice of Owl Trowel. And that was probably the last gag I added to the episode. There was one day where I sat in front of the microphone in the editing room for maybe an hour just to be like, you gotta get moose juice. you gotta get horse force. Like, I was so exhausted. And Owl Trowel was so dumb, I think it made the editor laugh, so we left it in.
Yeah, Kevin Licara would edit our these editor. Episodes, and he was just like super stoic. And if you made him laugh, we're like, we're onto something, baby.
Yeah, that's a good point. Our editor Kevin is just like this, like he's a funny dude, but he'd get into editing Vortex and he'd be really serious.
Yeah.
Just kind of like this big, kind of serious mountain sitting there. And then if you just heard him, you're just like, all right, we're keeping it.
Yeah,
it stays in. It permeated Kevin's focus.
Shout out to my boy Kevin Licara.
This is, I feel, a really satisfying reveal that Seuss is the driver.
Yeah, this is like a remnant of that thing you were talking about, Matt, where it's like he had 1,000 different jobs.
Yeah, I feel like in the thing he made a mention, I mean, it was like too much of a like plant early where he made a mention that he has to drive himself to work. Like
yeah.
He drives himself on the bus to get to another job or something, and it was like too much of a plant.
This scene, amazingly storyboarded by our director, John Aoshima. John, really experienced, has worked on Futurama, has worked on a bunch of shows, and he storyboarded the Gobblewonker chase in the second episode, which he directed, and he directed this as well. When we had scenes like this where we needed big, crazy action, nobody could deliver it like John. We had to cut a lot out of this for time, but it still came out great.
I remember when some of the CG stuff first came back, I thought that was like a terrible shading effect. Like, I didn't get that it was supposed to be half painted. And then it was like, I was like, their shaders are really bad. Like, what is the CG house you guys are using? It doesn't change with the sun or the light source.
I hope by the time we finished all the adjustments, most of the audience could tell that's just an unfinished Gideon bot. We like this idea of him kind of looking. Gideon is this character who presents this outward front of being sweet, but he's just this dark poison apple, and we like the idea of this giant robot representing kind of the two faces of Gideon. But yeah, it could just look like we screwed up.
No, I was just stupid. I totally got it after someone explained it to me.
This whole sequence was storyboarded by Alonzo Ramirez Ramos. Alonzo is one of our best storyboard artists, and they're all amazing, but he adds so much emotion to his work and so much imagination that we would often give him scenes where if we had something in a script that we weren't entirely sure if we could pull it off, we're like, in our dreams we could pull this off, but we don't know if we'll land it. We'd be like, Alonzo, solve it.
Yeah.
And every single time he would exceed our expectations. This crazy shot of Dipper jumping through the eye, like, we didn't know if it would work, and we saw his board, and it knocked us out.
Yeah, he has this, like, Miyazaki-sized imagination that's, like, amazing. The whole team is amazing. We got super lucky. And a lot of it was just, like, kids out of school, too. It's, like, we were just kind of kids out of school.
That's true. Alonzo, who boarded that sequence, and I think Mark Garcia did a bunch of additions on this. Alonzo had never done a storyboard before, professionally, before this series. We brought him on, and he's now won a bunch of Emmys. He's a director for Mickey now. He's incredible.
Yeah, he has a bathtub full of Annies and Emmys and Grammys.
Yeah.
Throw him a Grammy.
Yeah, like, he's too good to work for us now, but...
That's true.
We got him before we discovered him. This scene always, I remember when this episode premiered, I was watching the reactions live on Tumblr. I was just refreshing and seeing people's live comments, and the internet was on fire when Mabel comes down with that grappling. Like, people were so happy and satisfied. It's such a good feeling when you create the emotion you wanted to create. It doesn't always happen.
And we were like a little bit unhealthily obsessed with the fan reaction of the show. Like, I was like, I remember I one time went on 4chan and I was like, I work on Gravity Falls, and they're like, get out. They were like totally freaked out that I worked on Gravity Falls. It wasn't a good idea. I wouldn't recommend it.
This episode, my kids were like 3 and 5 at the time, and they cried multiple times. They cried when they thought they were moving away from Gravity Falls. They cried when they thought they'd blown up in the Gideon bot. And then when they finally come down on the grappling hook, they cried like a third time.
Oh, that's nice.
It's a little intense for little kids. We never thought about children at any point in the process. So it doesn't surprise me to hear that some of the stuff was too intense.
Is that me? The secret ingredient to my coffee omelet is
This whole thing of, we really love that everyone gets a hero moment. Dipper gets a hero moment punching through the glass. Mabel gets a hero moment coming down with the grappling hook. Seuss gets a hero moment by being the bus driver. And then Stan unexpectedly gets a hero moment outsmarting Gideon. Because we felt like it's not just enough for him to just get caught. Like, Stan has been his rival for so long, and he's been such a greasy little pig, so impossible to catch. Skylar the little handcuffs, or Tyler the little handcuffs, this always cracks me up.
And, or go ahead.
Oh, this was just a late retake we did. Sometimes we get animation back and we need to animate extra scenes. And originally Gideon was still wearing his ping pong ball mocap suit from the robot when the animation came back from this. And it felt unsatisfying to me to see weird pajama
Gideon. Yeah, you
couldn't
take it seriously.
Get carted away. It needs to be the Gideon we all know. So it was an expensive adjustment, but I stand by it.
Local hero Stanford Pines has just exposed little Gideon as a fraud. Anything you have to say to the town, Stanford?
The Mystery Shack is back!
Nice little piece of Stan palming the journal when he picks up the contract or the deed there. It was very well boarded.
Yeah, because originally the ending of this episode was just that Stan had the journal number one. And it just wasn't enough of a surprise.
Yeah, so this is another place where we have to give huge credit to Alonzo, our storyboard artist.
Matt, it was Alonzo and Matt. They were and they were like, "This is not acceptable."
Yeah, well, Alonzo, I mean, I remember him in particular. He was the one who convinced me. I think they came up with it together, and he campaigned for it. Where originally the ending was just Stan's got all the journals, and he's like, "I'm up to something."
Yeah,
and. You know, we had this idea of the portal and how it might work, but we were thinking of saving it for season two. And, you know, I think our artists, you know, as a writer's group, we have so many versions of the story in our head that they're all kind of floating around. But the artists get it fresh, and they get a first opinion like a fan. And their opinion was, we need something bigger.
Yeah.
And Alonzo boarded out that scene with Stan and the portal, and it was so awesome. And I was a little scared. I was like, is this too awesome?
Yeah.
Are we burning too much fuel here? But when you see something that good, you just have to say yes.
Yeah.
And it dramatically affected the shape of the second season.
I remember we had a writer's, we came in on a Saturday, like, oh, what are we going to do about this? And it's like, should we just do the portal? I mean, and everyone's like, yeah, the portal's kind of cool, right? yeah, let's do the portal. All right, it's 2 p.m., let's get some lunch.
Cut to me writing on the season two premiere. Mike has left the series to pursue other things. It's
just
like 3 a.m.
Tackling with my suitcase.
And I'm just like, why did we add that portal? How do I make this work?
Oh, there was a lot. I remember that. That just kept coming up in season two, where there's times it's like, if we just didn't show him do the portal, we could spend time on that now, but we can't show anything else until this point. Like,
I remember Alex kept calling me like, if we just didn't show the portal, and I'm just like, you know, in Tahiti, like, oh man, that's a real problem, Alex.
Wonder how you're gonna figure it out.
That little Easter egg there, that Stan's code that he puts in, that's a code that we see on the first page, or one of the early pages of the journal in the very first episode. And again, just a great addition by Alonzo. He really believed in this world and believed in these characters.
Yeah.
And would, sometimes some of the artists will take them even more seriously than you do and breathe life into them. And we were so knocked out when we saw this scene.
And the music is unbelievably great. Brad Breek killed it.
Brad Breek did an amazing job. I think we maybe had... Was it like Inception theme as our temp? And
that's right.
We weren't sure how he was going to top it. And of course, he like made it this version of the Gravity Falls theme that's huge and swelling. And I get story chills. I'm like, oh, I can't wait to see what happens. Like, I forget that it made me furious later that I had to follow it up. Oh, I still got him.
I kind of do, too. I've watched that scene like two or three times.
Didn't we have, I feel like Here We Go went through a few different iterations, right? Wasn't it? We could, like, it was hard to pick those last, like, what is the last thing he says?
We were trying to think of a joke, I think, and then it was fine, like, you know what? No, the audience is hyped. Let's just get them hyped.
Yeah, let's just have it be serious.